Good morning again. I'm still talking about Chapter 6 of Shanti Deva's Guide to the Bodhisattva Way. And as you may or may not recall, Shanti Deva was an 8th century Indian monk. And he wrote this text called Guide to the Bodhisattva Way. And so this is what it looks like in English. There are hundreds of verses, but the chapter we're talking about is chapter 6 on cultivating patience, which is often thought of as an antidote to anger. But you can think about it. These instructions are good for lots of different afflictive emotions, not just being angry. So we're up to chapter 14. I think this is the fifth lecture. Verse 14. I think this is the fifth lecture on this. So here's the first verse we're going to talk about. There is nothing whatsoever that is not made easier through acquaintance. So through becoming acquainted with small harms, I should learn to patiently accept great harms. Like, for example, this beep, 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 beep sound that's happening right now is a small harm, right? A small thing that we need to be patient with. So, first of all, it's important to remember this chapter is about cultivating patience, because there are some things about what he has to say that maybe are a little tough to take. You know, Shanti Deva is kind of like one of those tough love guys. You know, so he's very outspoken, and he really kind of has a high expectation for us, which is sort of nice in a way to raise the bar sort of high for us to meet this bar. But the first part of this says, remember he says, though there's nothing whatsoever, there's not easier through acquaintance. So acquaintance is this activity of getting to know our own mind. So this way in which we get to know how we respond to things based on the situations that arise for us. So essentially, a lot of our practice is about how are we responding to what's going on in our life? What is our response? Do we have equanimity? Are we skillful? Or do the things that happen really kind of throw us off kilter, cause us to be unskillful? So getting to know our own mind is really important. How do we respond to the various situations that we're in? So getting to know our own response to a situation is really important. What is it that we need to work on? Also to remember that our mind is not a fixed entity. We are not caught. We don't have to be caught, that we have flexibility. It is within our own capacity to be flexible, even though sometimes it feels like it's such a workout. I do not want to do this. You know, that's our mind saying, just, I don't want to be flexible. I don't want to change. And then the other thing is that situations themselves are flexible, but also situations themselves are not personal. So often when we're in a situation, it's like our response comes from some kind of personal animosity. Like if we get really angry about the sound of that, whatever that sound is, which we don't know what that is, right? So that sound is just the causes and conditions of something that's going on. But let's say that we think that that sound is being caused by a person. So maybe we would want to run outside and go, what are you doing? Don't you know there's a lecture going on here? Whoa, how could you do that? The Dharma's being preached, you know. But actually, it's just this coming together of a lot of causes and conditions. So a way in which we cultivate patience with that. So he's saying, there's nothing whatsoever that is not made easier through acquaintance. So developing this patience in trying situations, especially the ones that are not such a big deal to us, you know, the ones where we get a little bit upset, so we feel like we can actually work with that. We can work with something that feels very doable. You know, we can say, okay, I'm standing in line, I'm waiting for something to happen, I'm getting really impatient. Like that woman in the front of the line cannot seem to get her credit card out of her wallet, or that person is counting out all their money, including pennies. Well, their pennies, of course, I'm just telling you all the things that make me impatient, right? Because that's what I can relate to. So you have to think of the things that make you impatient. So that requires you to wake up to the fact that you're impatient and that you're having a difficult time. So this may not be your issue, but you probably have something else. Okay. So I'll tell you my issue. My issue is I stand in line, I watch somebody count their money out meticulously, and I'm like going, wow, gee. You know, and then I take a deep breath and say, oh, opportunity to practice patience. So this way in which we acknowledge and know and get to know ourselves and understand that we are being impatient, and this is a chance for us in a fairly non-confrontational situation, unless we want to make it one, non-confrontational situation to just relax and be patient with what's going on. Also, sitting zazen in many ways can be an activity of patience. So we know we're sitting zazen and our mind is kind of going all over the place. Maybe we're thinking about something that's getting us kind of agitated. You know, it's like when you're at home, one of the things about sitting zazen at home is it's amazing how many things you need to get up and do. Right? It's like you just sit down and all of a sudden, oh, did I feed the dog? You know, oh, did I do this? Did I do that? Oh, are the burners on? So you have to jump up and go look, right? In a way, this is a kind of impatience. This is a kind of agitation. So this way that we are patient with ourselves and sit in the midst of that, that we just sit with that and allow that to be what it is and not feel like we have to respond. So that's a kind of way of cultivating patience for our experience as human beings, for the way that our minds are when we sit zazen. So to look for those little ways that we can cultivate patience. It's kind of like building muscles. You know, when you start lifting weights or something, you can't pick up 350 pounds or 50 pounds or whatever it is. So you start with something that you can pick up and that you can pick up more than once. Like you can pick up without straining your back so that now you're, you know, incapacitated for the next 6 months. So this way in which you pick something up that's actually doable, and then eventually you build these muscles up and then you can pick up maybe 250 pounds or whatever it is. So that's what he's talking about here. So that's the first verse of today. There's nothing whatsoever that is not made easier through acquaintance. So through becoming acquainted with small harms, I should learn to patiently accept greater harms. So that's where we start out, with the small things. And he says harms because, you know, he's talking to that part of ourselves where why do we get agitated about things? Because we take them personally. Because we think somehow there's some harm here that we have to address that somehow is very personal for us in some way. So he's speaking to that part of our minds that get a little outraged, you know, when these things happen. Then he says, the next verse is, who has not seen this to be so with trifle sufferings? Now, I like this because remember, Shantideva lived in the 8th century. So these are trifling sufferings for him, such as bites of snakes and insects, feelings of hunger and thirst, and with such minor things as rashes. But of course, if you're not living in a urban environment, maybe you do have to deal with bites of snakes and insects. And we all have to deal with insects, although in Santa Cruz it's not so bad. But if you live in Texas, like I did for a long time, you know, the mosquitoes come out at night and you get bit by mosquitoes. So you have to, you know, accept the fact. And you know what it's like to have a bite? You know, it's like you just want to, you know, all the time kind of be messing with it. But the best thing to do is to just be patient, to not do that, right? So he's saying these are these kind of trifling sufferings that we go through. And being hungry or being thirsty. And such a minor thing as a rash. So these are kind of actually things that just afflict us as human beings that we have that happen. And he says, so be patient with that. And then he kind of ups the ante on this in the next verse. He says, I should not be impatient with heat, cold, wind, rain, and sickness. Okay, I think that's okay. But for us, this next one is going to be a little hard. Bondage and beatings. For if I am, the harm they cause me will increase. I have to admit there was a part of me preparing this lecture. I thought maybe I'll just skip the bondage and beatings part. Because it's kind of, that's a little hard. So this is one of the things about reading Shantideva, is that he brings in these really difficult things that we don't want to look at. He brings in these sort of tough kinds of ways of talking about this practice. So not being impatient with heat, cold, wind, and rain, sickness. You know, there's a koan, and it's called cold Buddha, hot Buddha. And the student says something like, oh gosh, it's, you know, really hot today, or it's really cold today. I really don't like it. I'm having a hard time with this, you know. And the teacher says, he says, well, I know there's a place where you don't have to be cold and hot. And of course, you know, we're like, yeah, where's that place, you know? And he says, cold Buddha, hot Buddha. So what he's saying is that actually that place is your mind. It's your response to what's going on. So the suffering that you're having about this is that you're rejecting heat and cold. You're saying, oh, I don't want to be hot. I'm suffering. I'm unhappy about it. I'm impatient with this, in a way. This makes me impatient. This kind of drives me crazy. And he's saying, well, actually, the way that you change that is through how you relate to it, as opposed to changing your environment. Because often, and I think as Westerners, this is maybe something that's harder for us, because we actually do successfully change our environment a lot. You know, if it's really hot, we go into an air-conditioned room. If it's really cold, we turn on the heat. But if you're living in an environment where, like I was just in Houston, it was 100 degrees. So, you know, it's true in Houston, you know, people, when I lived in Texas, you often go from an air-conditioned car to your house or whatever. Although I was in college, I didn't have air conditioning, I had a fan. And of course, there are a lot of people out jogging when it's 100 degrees. There are people outside working. There are people, you know, doing all the things that people do outside. And so they're not thinking about how hot I am. They're just, it's just what it is, right? They're just doing what they do. So I was thinking about this thing about bondage and beatings. Because I was thinking that one thing for us is that bondage and beatings brings up this notion of abuse. And I don't think any of us would like to say, let's be patient with abuse, right? That it's okay. I should cultivate my patience towards abuse. So I was thinking about, well, what is the practice of being in a situation like that? So what we're talking about here is we're talking about a kind of mental equanimity. We're talking here about a kind of mental stability which allows you to assess and respond to a situation in a way that's most skillful. Okay? So if we think about it from that point of view, he's saying don't be reactive. So if you're in a situation or you're of bondage and beating, or you're in a situation that's abusive, or you see somebody who's in a situation that's abusive, it behooves us to ask ourselves, what is the most skillful way that I can respond? Like, what's the most helpful thing that I can do? So it's not about not doing something. It's about, how can I do this in a way that's going to be the most efficacious? How can I do this in a way that's going to help the most? Like, for example, maybe what you want to do is kill somebody because they're being abusive. So you go out and you shoot somebody. I mean, that's a possible way of responding to a situation. But the problem with that is you might end up in jail. The problem with that is that it affects your own mental stability, not to mention the fact that you've just killed somebody. So there's this way in which there might have been another way to solve that problem. There might have been a way, if you'd had more mental equanimity and less reactive energy around that, that you could have been more skillful in that situation. You could have actually responded to the situation in a way that would be stop what was going on, and at the same time not gone to this extreme place of needing to kill someone. Do you get my drift here, what I'm trying to say? Because I think when we read something like this, our first response is something like bondage and beatings. Okay, I don't want to read any more of this. You know, I don't agree with this at all, the idea that I'm supposed to just patiently sit down and accept something like this. But I really don't think that's Shantideva's point. So don't lose your temper. Don't lose your ability to figure out what's going on. Escape if necessary. Maybe the thing to do is to escape. Maybe the thing is to assert yourself. I don't know the answer to that question because this is a kind of hypothetical situation. The other thing I thought about is, you know, in the disaster movies, like the guy who's always the one who, you know, Tom Cruise or whomever, Mission Impossible, they have a new one coming out. Tom Cruise, you know, they're always the guys who keep the cool head, right? They've trained and they trained and they trained, and then something catastrophic happens, like the world's coming to the end, the meteor is about to hit the earth, and they're like, well, okay, here's what we do. You know, I've had training now. I know I'm a SEAL. I'm an ex-Navy SEAL, and I can do this thing. But in a way, there's this way that what Shanti Devi is talking about is that kind of thing, that we train ourselves in this practice. We train ourselves so that when something extreme does happen, we have those skills to respond. We have that ability to avert the disaster. Here's the next verse. Some people, when they see their own blood, become especially brave and steady. But some, this is very imaginative, don't you think? Okay, some people, when they see their own blood, become especially brave and steady. But some, when they see the blood of others, faint and fall unconscious. These reactions come from the mind being either steady or timid. Therefore, I should disregard harms caused to me and not be affected by suffering. Okay. So now what he's trying to talk about here is our response to things reside in our minds. Things do not force us to have a certain response. It is so common for us as human beings to want to blame. We always want to say, you know, the he or she made me do this. We like to say that. We say, well, something made me do this thing. But actually, from a Buddhist perspective, and this is a tough teaching, it's a very tough teaching, which is, you know, we are responsible for our own responses. No one makes us get angry. No one makes us feel sad. No one makes us be greedy. All of those things that with this kind of afflictive emotions that we get caught in. Now, there are the causes and conditions of our life. There are all the things that happen to us that make us predisposed to some particular kind of affliction. We might be predisposed to respond with anger, predisposed to respond with greed, which is just this notion that I have to get more to be happy. Anger is the notion of I've got to get things away from me to be happy. And then there's the notion I've got to check out, like I can't cope with any of this, so you know, I'm going to ignore everything. And that's another kind of checking out. So we all have these ways that we think that if we do them, they're going to make us happy. So we have to take responsibility for that, because if we don't take responsibility for our suffering in a kind way, in an intelligent way, in a way that's not about beating ourselves up, it's very difficult for us to affect transformation. Because if we can't see the problem and take ownership of it on a certain level, we can't have transformation. So this is what he's saying. He's saying, well, why is it that some people, when they see their own blood, it doesn't bother them? And yet, some people, when they see the blood of others, faint and fall unconscious. So what's the difference there? What are we talking about here? We're talking about the mind of the person who sees the blood. We're not talking about the situation of seeing the blood. He's saying, well, different people have different responses to different things. And why is that? Why is it that we all 100% don't have the same response to everything that we come in contact with? So there's this way in which we always think that our response is the right response. Somehow that this is some fixed situation in which our response is the true way. And we don't even notice that other people are, we never ask the question, well, why is it that somebody else is having a different response than I do? Like, why is it that my friends, something that's happening bothers the bejesus out of me, but it doesn't bother somebody else? Now, gee, why could that, how could that be? But we don't usually ask that question. And what's the difference there? Well, it's because we have different minds. We have different ways of responding to things. So, I used to know this, there was this guy at San Francisco Zen Center. This was kind of my epiphany about this. There was a guy at San Francisco Zen Center I didn't like, because I had been with him at Tassajara and worked with him, and I thought he was kind of lazy. So every time I worked with him, I felt like I had to pick up the slack. And I didn't like that, so I didn't like him, because he wasn't doing essentially what I wanted him to do in the situation when I was with him, and I didn't like him. So the thing about it is, but I noticed that a lot of other people liked him a lot. And I couldn't figure out, like, why do they like this guy? Don't they know he's lazy? Like, you know, what's up with this? I don't like him. Why don't they dislike him? And then I was studying Shaktidevi, and I had this kind of, like, thought. I thought, oh, maybe the difference is, like, my mind. It's me. Right? I might be the one who's creating all this ill will. And that they're seeing a different person than I'm seeing. Like, I'm only dwelling on one quality of this person. I'm not thinking about this person as a whole person, right? And he was a very likable guy. The reason people liked him is because he was actually a very likable person. He was always nice to other people. He was always very kind. But for me, it was like I was filled with judgment because I thought he didn't live up to my standard of what he should be doing in some way. So I disliked him because he didn't live up to this standard. But, you know, for me, when I finally kind of figured out what was going on, that he wasn't the problem, I was the problem. That he was not the source of my suffering because he didn't do what I wanted him to do. That actually it was I was the source of my suffering because I had this mindset, this idea, and I was letting it color my response to him. I couldn't see anything but this one little narrow view of this person, which even then was like maybe suspect, you know. But I was still, you know. So it was my choice. I was making the choice. I was making the choice to be judgmental. I was making the choice to suffer. We do that a lot as human beings. We don't think we're making this choice. We think that someone else, some other situation or other person is making this choice for us. But actually, we're choosing to have this kind of mindset. This is a very profound teaching by Shaktidevi, you know. And the only way we can escape that suffering is a willingness to look at it, a willingness to look at ourselves and say, you know, gee, I'm suffering. I wonder if I might have something to do with this. I wonder if it's possible that the way I'm thinking about the situation might actually be creating suffering for myself. Now, the thing about this is that you have to be careful about this because I think that we have a tendency, when we take responsibility, we also have a tendency to beat ourselves up at the same time. So that's not helpful. Like, let's face it. When we feel bad about ourselves and we're beating ourselves up all the time, we're like, I'm out of dodge. I don't want to do this. So that's not helpful. It's not helpful to beat yourself up. I think what's much more helpful to say is this workable? Is what I'm doing working? It's kind of like a problem to solve. In a way, it's a problem to solve kind of outside yourself. It's like you say, well, you know, I did this thing. Is that very workable? Is that particularly helpful? Maybe it's not very helpful. I should look at this. And that I would like to change. Now, that sounds very analytical, and unfortunately, it doesn't work exactly like that. Because we do have this tendency to beat ourselves up. And then when we're getting beat up, the other part of ourselves is like, okay, I'm out of here. I don't want to do this. So then you have to come back to the teaching. So I'll tell you another story about myself. I'm in Tassajara. There's a woman there that I really dislike. See, I had a lot of stuff going on. I didn't like anyone. No, I had a few friends, Holly. I had a few friends. Now, there were like 30 people there, so we're only talking 2 out of 30, right? So anyway, so she and I would get into it each other, and including yelling at each other during silent times. So we had quite a thing going with each other. It was real love, right? But I remember I started reading Shanti David during that time, this thing about patience. And so I would, you know, read Shanti David. I'd say, yes, I really want to do this practice. This is my vow. And then I would go have an encounter with her, and all hell would break loose, and it would be like, you know, not very workable, not very skillful. So I'd go back and I'd say to myself, wow, that wasn't very workable. It wasn't very skillful. I really would like to do this and be skillful. And this other part of myself would say, you know something? I really don't like her. It's like, it's her fault that I'm feeling this way. And I'd say, oh, no. We want to do the practice. We're going to do this practice, right? And so, really, I mean, it's a little schizophrenic. But that would be what I would do. I would, like, give myself airtime to complain about this person. And then at the same time say, yes, be that as it may, we're going to still do the practice. And the practice is cultivating patience, not yelling at this person, you know, giving it some space. So there's this way in which we have to acknowledge the part of ourselves that doesn't want to do it. Because essentially that part of ourselves, in some way, we're annihilating the self. Does that make sense? That part of ourselves, in some way, is our defense mechanism. It's the way that we negotiate the parts of our world that are difficult for us. So we're asking that part of ourselves to do something really monumental. And yet, at the same time, this is our practice. At the same time, this is our vow. Our vow is to cultivate these skillful means. Our vow is to do this practice. And so we have to walk this kind of line between these two sides so that we can bring ourselves along to this more awakened viewpoint. But we can't drag ourselves, you know, on a leash, choking and screaming to the trough. We have to use a little bit of, reverse psychology. We have to remind ourselves about this. Okay, so then Shanti Davis says, even when the wise are suffering, their minds remain very lucid and undefiled. So this is talking about how we respond. For when war is being waged, even when the wise are suffering, their minds remain very lucid and undefiled. For when the war is being waged against the disturbing conceptions, which harm is caused... Okay, let's see if I can get through this. I'll try it again. Even when the wise are suffering, their minds remain very lucid and undefiled. For when war is being waged against the disturbing conceptions, much harm is caused at the time of battle. Okay, when war is being waged against disturbing conceptions, much harm is being caused at the time of battle. Okay, so what he's saying here is that if your mind remains lucid, if you keep your eye on the prize, as it were, so here you are having this little back and forth dialogue with yourself, or you're in the midst of your afflictive emotions arising with another person, that's the battle, right? That's where the war is being waged. So that's the battle he's talking about. He's talking about that battle that we're having with ourselves about being skillful, about being patient, about not wanting to be patient, or in the midst of a situation where we're being asked to be patient, where what's most required, what would be most helpful would be to be patient, to not engage in afflictive emotions. He's saying if we keep our mind lucid, if we kind of keep remembering what it is that the work we're up to, and remember we've been doing these little practices, these little, you know, 5-pound weights, all this time, you know, we've been at the supermarket line, in my case, or whatever it is that is yours, we've been doing those practices. So now we've got, like, bulging biceps. You know, we have the undefiled mind. We have the lucid mind. You know, like, okay, I got my spinach now. You know, we're ready to go. So we have this mind that is undefiled and lucid and ready to go into action. And that's where at that moment of making that decision, at that moment, that crossroads of how are we going to respond, or even if it's messier than that, right? Even if it's like me sitting in my cabin at Tassajara going, I will, I won't, I will, I won't, back and forth with each other. That's the battle, right? That's where we're actively engaged in this kind of juicy, messy conflict, internal conflict or external conflict. And that's where, when we can make transformation in that moment, that's what Shantideva is saying. Much harm is caused at the time of battle. The harm is, he's saying, the harm to the part that's unskillful. Does that make sense? That's not quite the language I would use if I wanted to describe this. But this way in which we are able to bring about the most efficacious response in that time of the most heat, when we are able to, it really sticks with you. You know, really sticks with you. I was just reading an article today in the Wall Street Journal, and they were talking about this guy who just won the British Open. And he said that when people play golf, when they practice, professionals practice, that there's not a lot of pressure on them while they're practicing. So in a way, the practice isn't as efficacious as it would be if somehow they could figure out a way to pressure themselves so they don't replicate the kind of experiences that you have when you're actually playing a match, when you're actually out there in the golf course, you know, competing. So this guy is figuring out a way to practice that kind of replicates that mental state. And they said that by doing that, what happens is when it really happens, when he's actually competing, that his mind is able to remember and retain that kind of equanimity that he could get through practice. Does that make sense? So this is exactly what Shantideva is talking about. He's saying that, you know, in these moments, that's when you really know that something has transformed. That's when you really know that something is happening there. Then he says, furthermore, suffering has good qualities. Through being disheartened with it, arrogance is dispelled, compassion arises from those in cyclic, for those in cyclic existence, evil is shunned, and joy is found in virtue. Furthermore, suffering has good qualities. It is suffering that causes us to want to transform. Have we not all had this experience? You're just saying, okay, I've had it. I am so floored. The way I think about it is, remember those little cartoons, the guy would be lying on the ground, he had the X's in his eyes and his tongue hanging out. Sometimes that's what it takes, right? We're just lying on the ground, our tongue's hanging out, our eyes are closed, we're going, uncle, I can't take anymore, I guess I'll have to change. And the last resort is that I have to change, but I'll do it because I just can't take it anymore. So he's saying, furthermore, suffering has good qualities because it drives us to want to change. Through being disheartened with it, arrogance is dispelled. So this arrogance being dispelled is when we, you know, when we're arrogant, this is this kind of prideful state where we think we're right, where we only see it from our point of view. So this is a way of describing this way that we create suffering for ourselves. And he's saying, okay, when you're really prostrate on the ground, you've really decided that you, in some ways, you feel defeated. You feel like you've, in a way, you've lost your self-confidence. You feel like you've just had enough. And at that moment, you're really open to realizing that this is the human condition, that you are not better than anybody else, that the problems that you have afflict everybody else, and that suddenly we're in this together. And when that happens, when that transformation happens and we feel connected with other people through our suffering, empathy arises out of that. And out of that empathy comes compassion. So compassion in English means passion, right? This feeling, this empathy with compassion with others. And when that starts to happen, we start to break down those barriers of separation. And then we start to see other people and we go, oh, they're being unskillful. I know what that's like. I know that comes from my own suffering when I'm unskillful. So I can be skillful in this situation because I know it's going to help alleviate that person's suffering and my own. Not pity, right? It's not pity, it's compassion. Compassion is this. It's a vertical relationship, right? This is hierarchical, horizontal, thank you, horizontal relationship. This is hierarchical, right, where you're going, oh, pity, I'm on top of this person, I'm giving them pity. Compassion is a way in which you're equal, right? So we're creating this kind of equality. Those encyclic existence just mean us, all of us, right, in the condition of rebirth, the cycle of rebirth. Why are we reborn in Buddhist terminology? It's because we're struggling with all these things. We're caught. We're pulled back into the next rebirth. Evil is shunned. So this evil is shunned is this way in which when we understand that we are in this together, at that point, that's the genesis and basis of ethics and morality in Buddhism. It's kind of like the Christian admonition, do unto others as you would like them to do unto you. So this way in which our compassion and empathy and morality arises out of the fact that we realize that we're not separate, that everything and every being and every person deserves respect, even when they are doing things that are incredibly unskillful, and that we understand on some degree what that's about, and that we are able to respond in a compassionate way and an ethical way. Because ethics is about taking the other person or the other being into account. Ethics is, when we're not ethical, it's because we think we're separate, we can do whatever we want to do, it doesn't matter how it affects anybody else. So the genesis of why do we not steal, why do we not kill, all those things, right? So out of that comes ethics. And then he says, joy is found in virtue. So we find this virtue, or this ethicalness, if you will, this way of being with each other, which actually makes us happy. It makes us happier to create happiness and to be moral and compassionate than it does for us to be immoral, curmudgeon, you know, angry, greedy, whatever it is. But once again, because we're doing all these unskillful things because we think it will make us happy, sometimes it's really hard to make that transition. But when you make that transition, you will find that there is joy and happiness in having made this transition. And we actually know now from studies, right, they're doing these studies, that we know that actually it does make us happier to be helpful to other people, to engage in these activities. This verse in and of itself is a kind of cascading verse in the sense that it builds on itself. So he says suffering has good qualities. When we are really feel that suffering and know how much it's creating suffering for ourselves and others, our arrogance is dispelled. Compassion arises from that dispelled arrogance. And from that, we stop being immoral or unethical. And out of that arises this joy found in the virtue of our activity. Thank you very much.